This is the first day of this December 2015 four-day sesshin, and I'm going to be reading from a book with talks and commentaries by Master Sheng Yan, a book basically put together by a man named John Crook, who himself was a Zen teacher, a Chan teacher, from Wales in England. And before I get going with Sheng Yan's words, just say a little bit about our connection with Sheng Yan. You know, Roshi Kaplow traveled to China and to Taiwan on occasions, and he did meet with Sheng Yan there. Actually, the if you've ever been to Temple Night, out in front of the Buddha Hall, there's a couple glowing sort of cones with various Buddha figures behind little windows. They've got a little electric motor, and they rotate and make a charming electric noise. Those were given to us, actually, by Sheng Yan when Roshi visited. Great deal of respect for him. Chinese Chan is different in many ways from Japanese Zen. Obviously, their similarities may be greater than their differences. But one of the big differences is that in China, a teacher such as Sheng Yan is a monk. It's not often the case in Japan. Most of the teachers who came over here from Japan were really they're priests, certainly. But most of them were married, and some of them went a bit beyond that. So I think we can say that for Sheng Yan, maybe a more basic Buddhist approach, more emphasis on the precepts, on repentance, and he had a really remarkably clear teaching, as we'll see, hopefully, as we get into this. The compiler of the book, this fellow John Crook, established a sort of a Zen group in Wales, which is where he lived. The name of the farm, Errol taught me how to pronounce it, and I'm going to try, but I think I've already forgotten it. I think it's Errol, go ahead and say it. What she said, Mind Floyd. Anyway, and it's not spelled anything like that either. And those are L's that sound like F. He founded the group was called, I think, the Western Buddhist Order. I'm not sure. I'll have to check before I say that. There may be some other group in England by that name. At any rate, a number of people sat with him, and he became connected with Sheng Yan. He found him as a teacher and came over to this country where Sheng Yan had a center. The center still exists in Queens, and then a monastery in New York, upstate New York. And he invited Sheng Yan to come and hold a sesshin for this group of his in Wales. And this basically, all these talks come out of this first sesshin that Sheng Yan did there in England, in Wales. When Roshi Kaplow died in 2004, we got an email from John Crook offering his condolences. And he said that he himself had been sanctioned to teach and was teaching some in Poland. And he commented that in Poland, there were a number of people there who were quite up in arms about what they felt was Roshi Kaplow's lack of acceptable credentials. As most people know, there was a break between Yasutani Roshi and Philip Kaplow that happened in the late 60s, just before I think I got here to the center. One person said that Yasutani sort of launched Philip Kaplow into space. what John Crook said was that, to his mind, the integrity and the dedication of Roshi Kaplow more than made up for any lack of papers. And I thought it was really touching that he brought up that point and had such kind things to say, immersed as he was in the whatever currents were going on there in Poland. I believe that Roshi's sister, Sonia, still goes there and gives sesshin, but there are now many, many different strands of Zen in Poland, as there are in many countries and throughout this country and many cities. You can't really swing a cat without hitting a Zen teacher anymore. Not that you would want to. So I'm going to begin. This book that I'm reading from is called Illuminating Silence. It's not clear whether the author is considered to be Sheng Yan or John Crook, but it's edited with introductions and commentaries with John Crook, and I believe it's his book. And he includes here the autobiography, so written by Sheng Yan, and let me just read from it. It says, "I was born into a family of poor farmers who lived in the countryside outside Shanghai. My peasant father did not have his own land, but worked in the rice fields owned by others. He was a kind man, and I never saw him angry," which is pretty remarkable. "Both my parents were intelligent, but my father said very little, while my mother was more forthcoming. I had three brothers and two sisters. My brothers remained on the land, and none of my brothers or sisters was interested in becoming a monk or a nun. As a child, I was very slow to develop, and only when I was six did I start talking." That's pretty remarkable. I think in this country, a child that didn't talk until was six would be in some sort of special education program. We would be trying to figure out what was wrong and what sort of interventions we could do. But in China, maybe a little differently. And it may be that there was some understanding that this could be a sign that it was a remarkable child. He really is pretty reticent about that, and it's just a different culture. I remember reading the also an autobiography of a Zen, an ancient Chan teacher, who said that when he was a child, he never liked to play with the other children. He would just sit upright with his back completely straight, and he had an uncle who said, "This child is like a pole." Said, "Even then, after I began to talk, I couldn't tell left from right, nor tell the time. When I was seven, the master who was to become my first teacher wanted to find a disciple. He asked the Buddha where to look." Not sure exactly how that works, but we'll go with it. "The Buddha told him to go to the source of the Yangtze River, so he looked in that direction. One of his lay followers happened to be a neighbor of ours. One day, when it was pouring with rain, he was walking by and stopped in front of our house. The rain was so heavy that he came into our house to escape the downpour. As he was talking to my mother, he noticed a small boy in the room, myself. He asked my mother whether it would be all right if this little boy became a monk. My mother said, 'Oh, that is his choice. If he wants to, that's fine by me.' So the man asked me if I would like to be a monk, but I did not know what a monk was. Nevertheless, he wrote my name down and my birth date and put them up in front of his Buddha image and left them there. Half a year later, he came back and asked if this was the correct choice, and the Buddha said yes." Okay. "You know, in some Chinese temples, the sticks of the I Ching Book of Divination are used to choose disciples, but the method whereby I was chosen was very unusual in China. It actually sounds a little bit like the Tibetan system, where monks go out looking for the reincarnation of a master who's died, But I don't know. At the age of 8, I started primary school, and in my fourth year of school, the war between Japan and China started. At 13, I left school to become an ordained monk, which meant having my head shaved by Lun Wei, the monk who sought me out, and I studied with him for 5 years. His own master had been the great Chan master Su Yun. So I am in Su Yun's lineage in the Linchi or Rinzai tradition. Of course, Su Yun is the great Chinese master of the 20th century, died I think somewhere around 1959, if I'm not mistaken. So lived through some of the Cultural Revolution and suffered at the hands of some of Mao's thugs. There's a pretty remarkable book about him. Su Yun means literally empty cloud. Said, none of us young monks had any idea of the nature of Chan training, and we received no adequate instruction. We simply followed the rigorous discipline of monks, washing clothes, working in the fields, and performing daily services. I had to memorize sutras, and at this I proved singularly inept. It's really interesting. No adequate instruction. And I've heard this in the stories of other masters. I think things have changed a bit in modern times, and everyone gets an adequate explanation. We understand what we're doing, we understand why we're doing it. I've heard Yasutani say that for Westerners that's kind of essential. But in a traditional culture where Buddhism and Chan here is just part of the atmosphere, people don't necessarily require as much hand-holding. There's just a faith that this is the way to go. However, I think it would be good to have some instruction in how to sit, and I don't think he's saying that that was ideal. My master told me that my karmic obstructions were very heavy and made me prostrate endlessly to Guan Yin, that's Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva, or Guan Yin. I prostrated 500 times every night and again in the morning. It's a lot of prostrations. You know, some people have taken that up. I hear from people from time to time, perhaps in a term intensive or just in their own practice doing prostrations, and I've never done anything near this number, 500 every night, 500 again in the morning. After 3 months, I felt a curiously refreshing experience. My mind became clear, and I no longer found memorization a problem. Even today, I believe Guan Yin came to my aid, for I was really very dull of mind until that time. It's interesting because Sheng Yan became something of a scholar, as you'll see later, but it seems like he started out with a mind that, at least superficially, was quite different. None of us knew anything of the history of Buddhism, either in China or India, and few Chinese had any understanding of the Dharma or much respect for it. Buddhism was still in severe decline, and the monasteries provided little in the way of an appropriate education. What education there was through daily experience. I felt the value of the teachings, but was sad that they were venerated by so few. I vowed to study so that I might bring the teachings to others. Due to the spread of communism, we moved into Shanghai, where we monks made ends meet by performing the rituals for the dead. Eventually, I ran away from my monastery to study at a school in the city where young monks could obtain some formal instruction. My master eventually approved of this move. Again, there's a lot unsaid in there. The seminary was founded by Master Taizu, who with Master Su Yun revived Chinese Buddhism in the early 20th century. Tai Tzu followed the line of thought of the great Ming Dynasty master U Yi. Not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but I'm pretty sure I'm not, who disapproved of sectarianism, insisting that there was really only one Buddhist tradition with varying aspects. He placed equal emphasis on the eight schools, Huayan, Tiantai, Chan, Weishi, which is Siddhamatra, Vinaya, some form of Madhyamika, the Pure Land School, and Tantra. I studied history in the Tiantai, Huayan, Weishi, and Vinaya teachings. The Vinaya is the, as Roshi often says, the rules and regulations, the teachings of morality and proper conduct for monks. There was also an emphasis on the physical exercises of Tai Chi and boxing. Also, ritual repentance was much stressed. We practiced meditation, but without adequate instruction. I simply did not know what I was supposed to be doing. I puzzled over this so much that I became a great bag of doubt. Only when the bottom fell out of the barrel were we allowed to see the master, but nobody seemed to know what this meant, and my doubts could not be resolved at this time. So basically they were told that unless they'd come to awakening, they couldn't see the teacher. The war years were very bad. When the exiled Chinese government went to Taiwan, I was in the army and went with them. So between the ages of 18 and 28, I was a soldier. There was no way I could leave the army between 1949 and 1959. Again, you really wonder what that was like. After that, I became a monk again and lived in a temple in Taiwan and edited the magazine Humanity. So evidently he'd had some education by then. I was in training, of course, and attended retreats. The great doubt persisted. I was constantly wondering what enlightenment or Buddhahood was. There were so many contradictions in the teachings that I could make no sense of them. The deeper I looked, the worse it became. When I was 28, I had a profound experience of dropping the mind. I had been practicing a lot and had had some small experiences, yet all these questions kept running through my head. I went on retreat in a monastery in southern Taiwan where a famous monk, Ling Yuan, was visiting. One night he and I were sharing the same sleeping platform. Seeing that he was meditating, I sat with him. These questions were going round and round in a circle, one leading to another. They were all about the nature of vexations, life, and death. After some hours, it was past midnight, and these questions became intolerable. I asked the master whether I could ask him a question. He said yes, but when I started, there was this sudden flow of questions. Like water, they all poured out of my mouth. It went on and on for 2 to 3 hours. I really felt I needed answers from this monk, who seemed so free and easy in himself. All he did was to listen. He said nothing or simply asked, "Any more?" It was very strange. I had started with one question, and suddenly there was this endless flow. It was the great ball of doubt. Finally, the master sighed, lifted his hand, and struck the bed hard. "Put it down," he said. Suddenly, my mind seemed to snap. I was pouring with sweat and felt a great weight being suddenly lifted from me. There was nothing there. It seemed that there was no problem anywhere in the world. Everything had gone. We simply sat on, not saying a word. I was extremely happy. The next day, the whole world was fresh, as if I were seeing it for the first time. Again, so little explanation. You wonder if Ling Yuan even congratulated him. I was extremely happy. The next day, the whole world was fresh, as if I were seeing it for the first time. In the practice of meditation, it is not possible to see the nature, though willing it or even intending it. By see the nature, it's really a translation of Kensho. You have to let go into purposeless practice. If there is a purpose, the discriminating mind is active and the ego is present. You just work hard on your method. It is not waiting. It is not even not waiting. It is essential to bring positive causal conditions together so that one can practice under the guidance of someone who has sufficient insight to be a guide, not just any teacher will do. One of the things I like about Chinese Zen and Shengyan is the slightly different language that they use, where we would almost always say practice. You just work hard on your practice. Shengyan says you just work hard on your method. So your method may be a koan, it may be the breath, it might be shikantaza, or what they call silent illumination. It's so difficult to get to this state of where it's not waiting, it's not even not waiting. It's really without a purpose. Practice for its own sake. When I had at last left the army, I found a certain master, Dong Chu, who I sensed to be an extraordinary individual. He neither lectured nor gave instructions on practice. He seemed to have had a great affinity for people who didn't talk. Though he himself was quite verbal, quite eloquent. Yet, about this master, yet seeking neither fame nor followers, he was widely respected. He was an heir to both the Linji and the Kaodong lineages, that's the Rinzai and the Soto lines. His way of speaking was startling and could affect people deeply. My stay with him was rough indeed. He treated me much as Marpa, the great Tibetan Lama, had treated his disciple Milarepa. Milarepa is sort of the great saint of Tibet, and anybody who's read his life knows that Marpa really worked him over, building houses and tearing them down and giving him just a stream of constant criticism and correction. So this teacher, Master Dong Chu, he would tell me to move into one room and then into another and then back again at once. He told me to seal off a door in a wall and open another. Although we used a gas stove, I had to fetch logs from high up in the hills so that he could brew tea over them. I never got the wood the right size. It was always too large or too small. Similarly, when I sat, he would say, "You cannot become a Buddha by sitting. Mirrors are not made by polishing bricks." I was then ordered to do prostrations. After several days, he would say, "This is nothing but dog eating shit. Go read the sutras." So I would read for a couple weeks, and he would say, "The patriarchs thought the sutras only good for cleaning sores. Go and write an essay." When I had done it, he would tear it up, saying, "These are only stolen ideas. Using your original wisdom, say something." Whatever I did was wrong, even when I had done exactly what he had told me to do. Furthermore, because we were supposed to meditate at night, he wouldn't let me keep a blanket for sleeping. This harsh teaching was actually very compassionate. Without him, I would not have realized much. The message was that one had to become self-reliant in the practice. It's interesting. Without him, I would not have realized much. And this was after his awakening. So obviously, Shengyan had real drive to deepen his understanding and to come to a deeper awakening. After 2 years, I decided to go into a solitary retreat in the mountains. I told him I had vowed to practice hard so as not to fail the Dharma. "You are wrong," he said. "What is this Dharma? What is Buddhism? The important thing is not to fail yourself." After that, I found a remote spot in the mountains and did a solitary retreat for 6 years. I lived in a small hut that looked out over onto a cliff. So this is probably sometime in the 1960s, I imagine. Clearly, since he was in the army until 1959 and then for at least a couple years with this master. So, yeah. I lived in a small hut that looked out onto a cliff. There was a small courtyard, and although I always remained within it, I never felt closed in. All the time I felt calm and settled as if I had come home. I ate one meal a day of wild potato leaves, which I planted myself. Originally, I only intended to do 3 years. During the first one, I spent most of the time doing repentance prostrations. The second year I spent in meditation and reading sutras, and the third was the same. Then I realized there was simply not time enough, so I continued, but also began to read and study. I also started to do research and to write. In this manner, I spent half my time meditating and half in study. After 6 years, I had written several books and learned to read Japanese. I then stopped my retreat and went to Japan for further studies, taking a doctorate in Buddhist literature at Risho University in Tokyo. I also went on retreats, especially with Bantetsugu Roshi, a disciple of Harada Roshi, and I believe this is Dayun Harada, who's the teacher in our line, Roshi Kaplow's first main teacher at Hoshinji. Although Harada is one of the most common Japanese names, sort of like Smith. I attended winter-long retreats at his temple in the harsh environment of northern Japan. He was particularly scathing about my learning and studying at university. When I left him, he told me to go and teach in America. I complained that I did not know English. He said, "Do you think Zen is taught with words? Why worry about words?" That's as far as he takes it. And he did. Then he came to this country and was some years later that this retreat that we're going to go into happened. When he came, he was the founder of the new Dharma Drum Modern Buddhist Association, Mountain Buddhist Association, incorporating the Chung Hwa Institute of Buddhist Studies in Taipei and Taiwan, and he had a related institute in the USA, which ran the Chan Meditation and Retreat Centers in New York. He was also an abbot of another monastery in Taipei and a professor in the university philosophy department, and was at the time splitting his time between Taiwan and the United States, spending about 6 months a year in each. The Chan students call their master Shifu, meaning teacher, a term equivalent to the better-known Japanese Roshi. So in this text, he refers to him as Shifu. And coming to this retreat in Wales, he brought along a monk in residence at the Chan Center in New York, who was acting as the abbot there, and also an interpreter, Mr. Mingyi Wang. And most of this book is John Crook's reworking the translations that Mingyi Wang did there at the retreat. So I'm going to plunge ahead. With that bit of introduction to his arrival. And this is entitled Arriving in Wales. And this is Sheng Yan speaking. I expect some of you can understand that getting to Wales has been somewhat like undergoing a Chan retreat. In the last 3 days, we have spent over 50 hours on planes, without a proper night's sleep, and with a complete uncertainty as to whether we were actually going to arrive. Yet here we are, and I can see that you are all ready to begin. Everything is arranged. You all have your places marked and your jobs allocated, so we must certainly start at once. You know that I intended to come here last year, but at that time we were not aware that I had to have a visa. So a little short on the planning department there. Then this year, we got the visa, but when we arrived at the Taipei airport, we found it had just expired. What an obstruction. The only thing to do was to fly at once to New York, where it would be easy to get another visa. So we spent a few hours in New York and got onto another plane. Would you believe it? The plane developed a fault before takeoff, and we all had to disembark. Of course, we were very tired even by that time. You can understand that at the moment, the only thought in my head is sleep. I shall not say very much now. Actually, I should tell you that we almost gave up the idea of coming. But then I thought of all the work you have done, John especially, in arranging this event, and I felt that on no account could I let you down. So here I am. This is then a very precious occasion. Despite numerous obstacles, it has come about. I hope each one of you will treasure the opportunity and work hard. It's kind of remarkable how often something that's really significant and important is preceded by difficulties. I'm remembering when Bodhin Roshi, when our Roshi went to India to meet with the Dalai Lama, he missed his flight. And another lack of planning, no doubt. And it seemed like there was just no way to get there. And if they did get there, they would be late. And he, too, was on the verge of just hanging it up. But Sante, Sensei at the time, Sante, now Sante Roshi, pointed this out, that the difficulties themselves were an indication of how meaningful this trip might be. And they did. They went and got there, I think, like a day late. And it was a really good visit. Says, now tell me, how many of you have never experienced a retreat before? How many of you have done three or more retreats? I imagine hands are going up around the room. Has anybody participated specifically in a retreat in the Soto tradition or in the Rinzai tradition? Has anybody read any of my books? Oh, two of them. Great. You will know that Zen, Chan in Chinese, is not for the purpose of getting instant enlightenment. Rather, the practice itself is the goal. Most people think that seeing into one's own nature using some method of instant enlightenment is a convenient and speedy path, but this is a severely erroneous understanding. Of course there is enlightenment, but mostly there are false enlightenments. If you are very anxious to get enlightened, you can precipitate the kind of mistaken experience that you call enlightenment. That can be very sad. It really is tricky, and of course we see kind of a contrast between the Rinzai school and the Soto school, much more emphasis on coming to awakening in the Rinzai tradition. And in the Soto line, I've heard of teachers saying, I don't even want to ever use the word Kensho. And then you have problems with both approaches, because if you're emphasis is completely on coming to awakening, and you do, then you've kind of taken care of your purpose. And we see this with people who've had some sort of initial insight. There is suddenly the wind can go out of their sails. Sometimes you need to be careful and not take a small experience to be the fruit that you were hoping to bring forth. I think it's really inspiring in the Three Pillars of Zen when Roshi Kaplow came to his awakening. One of the Doksans before he had his experience, he had had a little bit of an insight, and Yasutani said, you know, there are some teachers who would approve a small experience like this. And Roshi's immediate response was, I wouldn't accept your sanction if you gave it. I didn't labor like a mountain all these years to bring forth this mouse. Just the whole thing of hanging your hat on experiences. It is wonderful. It's wonderful to get free from our sense of separation, to see without the intervention of any kind of thought or conceptualization. and it can be life changing, but there's so much work to be done, and it's to live for an experience, and then to live in the memory of that experience is, as he said, can be very sad. The other side of it, of course, is the Soto approach, where we practice for the sake of our practice, and there is no concern with enlightenment. And that can have its problems too, because there are so many Soto teachers who have no real understanding. It's certainly not the case that no Soto practitioner comes to awakening. And in fact, in either tradition, there are people with great aspiration and dedication, and we just need to... we need a teacher who will keep our feet to the fire. It says, after so much difficulty in getting here, I have not come to give you enlightenment. That would be absurd. Rather, I have come to see whether it is possible to pass on to you the methods whereby you can improve your practice. It's really a nice way of putting it. It is like eating. We cannot expect to be filled by taking one mouthful or munching once or twice. We need to ingest a whole meal until we know we have had enough. We are going to use the methods of practice to benefit the body and mind. That is the most important thing. He goes through the various methods that that he uses: breath practice, silent illumination or shikantaza, and the koan system, just as we do here. And he says, just as we had problems in getting to Wales, so too will you encounter obstructions in the practice of your method. These arise from your own body and mind, not from anywhere else. One simply has to persist and continue with practice. Be prepared for struggle. We have 6 days ahead of us. Of course, we here have only 4. And even to recognize the obstructions is in itself the beginning of true practice. These obstructions arise from our own mind and body, not from elsewhere. It may seem like an obvious point, but our tendency is always to see the problem coming from outside. It's always conditions that are getting in my way. My legs hurt, my back aches, my mind is abuzz with thought. I have these obstructions. But they're exactly what we need. That's exactly where we need to work. To distance ourselves from them, and to think, if only conditions were better, then I could get more deeply into my practice, is to miss the whole point. He says, be prepared for struggle. It's a privilege to be able to struggle with our obstructions. Be able to get to know them. Sometimes people who have physical pain in zazen get to a point where that pain is completely gone, and they can even miss it. I know I found periods where all of a sudden it seemed like I needed that prodding, and when it was gone, things went a little flat. No matter what the conditions are, we can make a problem out of it. And no matter how bad they are, we can return to the practice. So we need to cultivate the spirit of a happy warrior. It's always so exhilarating to see someone who just says, bring it on. And we all have that ability. to sit together with so many other people, their energy added to ours, to have this form that contains our efforts, directs them, to be relieved from so much of what we deal with in our daily lives. Here at least it's clear if anxiety or drowsiness or anything rears its head, it's not coming from our overburdened lives. We've brought it here with us. A real chance to come to grips with so much, and it has such an effect over time. If we continue to do this practice, it changes so much in our lives. It changes people around us. To us comes this gratitude for somehow having stumbled onto this practice. And of course, the only way, the best way to repay that debt of gratitude is to do the practice alongside others, knowing that our efforts help others, just as others' efforts help us. Three more sentences from Sheng Yen. It says, "In this small house, we are hidden away in the mountains. The moment is auspicious. Now sit." Time is up. We'll stop and recite the four vows.